We will call the Tax Committee to order for April 14th, 2015. Senator Sieben, Senate File 1838, and we're just a little light on members, but there are no amendments, and I understand that the Senate authors all have conflicts coming up, so we're going to start and try to work through this. Welcome, Senator Sieben.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you for accommodating my schedule this morning. This Senate File 1838 is a TIF extension for the city of Cottage Grove. With me today is the mayor of Cottage Grove, Myron Bailey. I'm happy to give an overview, or perhaps, Mayor Bailey, you just want to dive into it.
Yeah, I could do that.
Welcome, Mayor Bailey.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I am Myron Bailey, the mayor of the city of Cottage Grove, and I'm here today to ask for your vote in support of Senate File 1838. This bill, if adopted into law, will allow us to repurpose a long vacant property in our community. Without adoption of this bill, I fear that blighting influences will continue to fester within our most important commercial district in Cottage Grove. Our situation is that we have a 208,000 square foot, mostly vacant shopping center. In 2008, a 5-year-old Home Depot closed. Last year, a Rainbow grocery store closed in the same center. So now 180,000 square feet of a 208,000 square foot center is sitting vacant. If nothing is done, we believe additional tenants will leave and the property will drop in value to now not much more than the land value of $7.8 million and perhaps less. If we are successful in repurposing the center, we believe the value of this property will increase to at least $18 million and job opportunities will return. We are not asking for an extension of a tax increment district. We are not asking to spend funds on anything other than what is already allowed for under state law. We are also not asking to spend outside of the adopted budget for an existing tax increment district. What we are asking for is the opportunity to spend funds that are already being created within an existing tax increment district, but due to the age of the district, we are not able to access these funds as they were originally intended. Under the law, tax increment expenditures must either be spent on debt retirement or on capital expenditures that occur within a few short years of the TIF district creation. Our district was certified in 2002, and therefore we are beyond the 5-year deadline to extend funds on TIF-eligible expenditures. We are requesting the opportunity to access funds for expenditures occurring in 2015 and 2016. These funds are created within the existing TIF district. Having access to these funds will allow our community to solve a problem that we did not create, but one which we are left to solve. The private market has not been able to do this. There has been many attempts that have failed to redevelop the site, but now it rests with us. This is the perfect example of the requirement of the but-for test for the use of tax increment. I need your help in support of this problem for our community. I thank you for your time, and we'll take any questions.
Mayor, what was on the land when the original redevelopment TIF was implemented back in 2002?
Part of the area that this curtailed in the TIF area actually was blank land, actually. It was just housing in one particular area where we currently now have a Kohl's department store and some other infill like Walgreens and Caribou and all those places. The edge of this TIF district, which is where this mall is located that we're talking about, which was part of the TIF, was a mall that was viable at one time, as I mentioned, with the Home Depot and Rainbow Foods. But since that particular time, those two tenants have left, and we're left with having some issues getting that center repurposed.
And so what was there before the Home Depot? Was that also shopping?
It was a shopping center at one point. Yeah, a long time ago. It used to be like a National Foods and a Kmart, I guess, in that center at one particular time, too.
And what is your proposal to do with those two large empty buildings in this plan?
What we're proposing to do as part of it, and I should mention if there's any questions too, I forgot to mention that earlier, our finance director, Robin Rowland, for the city of Cottage Grove is behind me here. We are hoping that we will purchase a portion of the building, which is the Home Depot section, and use some of this funds and then work with a proposed end user to repurpose the center. We believe we are progressing down the path right now with a couple possible entities, but we need some additional tax increment funds for some infrastructure improvements in that, and this is why we're looking at, for your help on this.
And the would your expectation be the end user would be more shopping, or would it be other uses?
More shopping. It would be more of a commercial entity, though we have, just to state it, we have been speaking specifically to a YMCA who has been interested in coming to Cottage Grove. So there is a possibility of that happening there. We do not have a fitness facility in our community, and so that is one of the options we're speaking about.
Okay. And then I think from my notes here, the original cost was $30 million and the TIF contribution is $5 million. Do those numbers sound right?
Yes,
Mr. Mayor?
That is correct.
Okay. Any questions, members? I think we've got a pretty good handle on it. Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1838? Senator Sieben, anything else?
No, thank you for taking the time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you for coming, Mayor Bailey.
And hope you support us.
Chair will lay Senate File 1838 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Senator Saxog. Senator Saxog, Senate File 1011.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 1011 ensures that the area-wide tax rate for the Iron Range Fiscal Disparities Program will not deviate by more than 3 percentage points from the previous year's rate. And with me today is Lauren Solberg, representing Itasca County, to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions.
And Senator Saxog, so what this is doing is putting a 3% annual movement to the fiscal disparities pool redistribution?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Saxog.
Yes, it is. But that doesn't mean that it's reducing it. It just means that it's, what's the word?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, Lauren Solberg, I represent
Mr. Solberg.
Itasca County and City of Grand Rapids. If you recall, in the last year when the report was made from the Taconite area of fiscal disparities, one of the recommendations or the difficulties was the volatility of the fiscal disparities. And we looked at different ways of being able to have some smoothing out of that volatility without having a big administrative cost associated with it. I worked with Mr. Dicklich, who is the auditor of St. Louis County, along with the auditor of Itasca County, and they feel comfortable with this way of being able to soften or to smooth out that volatility. It's something that can be administered fairly easily. We also considered a three-year averaging, but that becomes more difficult in being able to administer that. So the goal of this is just to have a little bit more predictability into the fiscal disparities in the Taconite relief area. And it also is kind of a response to the report that was made last year.
And Mr. Solberg, just so I can understand, it can go 3 percentage points in any given year. It can go up or down, but by no more than 3 percentage points.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I also have met with the Department of Finance, and they're comfortable with this. It is a delayed 1 year for it to be able to get a small adjustment in the computer system that administers this.
And Mr. Solberg, on page 2, line 14, it's referencing an auditor. Is that the county auditor?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so, yes.
Okay.
That's the auditor that administers the program.
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Solberg, are you wed to 3%, or could we consider going to 5% deviation? I'm just wondering, you know, if a larger industrial commercial project got built, seems like if we had a 3% deviation in some community might be pretty small. We might take us years and years and years to ever capture that growth. I'm wondering if something as 5% is something that was ever considered.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Solberg.
Senator Bach. I'm not wed to 3%. I think that the percentage can be just about anything as long as it's somewhat reasonable. I think 5% is also considered in one of the other laws that we have. Is that, I'm not sure, homestead credit or one of those. So if 5% is more comfortable with the committee, I'm sure acceptable to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I think it's the it's a concept we're thinking about here. Yeah.
Well, I understand.
Anything else, members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify on Senate File number 1011? Senator Saxog, we will continue to work on this percentage and see what we can come up with. We'll make sure you're in the loop on all that. We'll touch base with Senator Bach also. Seeing nothing else, member, Chair will lay Senate File number 1011 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Saxog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Osmick. Senator Osmick, looks like we're going to make your 9:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My client will be very happy. Actually, I have two different clients that I'm serving this morning. So,
Senate File 1830.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is Senate File 1830. I do have an amendment I know you can't act upon yet.
No, we have a quorum. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. Quorum is present.
Then, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for an author's amendment, A1.
Senator Gazelka moves A1 author's amendment. Do we have that in our packet?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1830 is an amendment to the Ag Preserve laws in the state of Minnesota. Ag Preserve is a 30-year-old program instituted to protect farmers in the seven-county metro area from encroachments by development. Once enrolled, the program requires a minimum of 8 years participation and requires a minimum of 8 years to exit the program. Many parcels on the developing fringe of the metropolitan area are smaller parcels of land, often farmed by people who are in their more senior years. When an owner-operator passes away, it's a game-changing event for the operation of the farm. Many times, the surviving spouse or heirs may not be able to maintain or continue the farm operation. Because the land is located in the developing metro fringe, in order to pay real estate taxes, a family may find it more difficult to dispose or convey property as a result of fewer farmers in the area and because of the highest best use is no longer agricultural. Senate File 1830 is a voluntary option to revoke the Ag Preserve Covenant. In Subdivision 2, we provide for a 180-day window if an owner dies that the owner's property can be removed from Ag Preserve's qualifying status. It also defines a qualifying person and survivor or surviving owner. Later in Subdivision 2, a 50% penalty of the current taxable amount is instituted for the revoke of the covenant. The A1 amendment also provides language to allow cell towers into an existing Ag Preserve land covenant. 30 years ago, when Ag Preserve was initiated, cell phone service and GPS farming were non-existent. Obviously, today that is not the case, particularly in the case of GPS farming. Cell tower land is leased, and the revocation of the Ag Preserve allows heirs to sell their land to the highest and best use. So I would request that you support this bill. It's a good common sense bill that actually will have very little impact. I was provided information that about approximately 5 parcels of land in the metropolitan area may be affected per year, and the actual cost was identified as negligible as far as a fiscal note.
And Senator Osmick, are you concerned that the owner who passed on maybe had intended for the land to stay in Ag Preserve?
Pardon me?
The owner that passed on, maybe he intended for the land to stay in Ag Preserve.
That's entirely possible, Mr. Chair. However, then he also has his will and last will and testament that can actually identify saying, I do not want my land moved. And it doesn't necessarily say it in the bill, but certainly last will and testament would probably solve that situation.
And Senator Osmick, the amendment, wireless communication cell towers, how is that a related farming activity?
It's not necessarily a related farm activity except in the case of farmers that are using GPS to farm their locations. Adding cell towers into existing ag preserves allows us to expand our network of cell towers. In my particular area, we have some of these ag preserves where we can't get cell towers in because of the ag preserve qualification. The requirements of ag preserve really don't allow you to put up a cell tower, which right now is approximately a 50-foot by 50-foot section of land, so that we can have better coverage in the metropolitan area. I think cell towers should be a reasonable accommodation to add into an ag preserve area. It doesn't. It's not a building. It's not an act. It's not a non-agricultural necessarily use. It just allows for better cell phone tower access.
Well, GPS technology does not use cell. It's a separate technology, not cellular, so that wouldn't have any impact on it. I would question the use of wireless cell technology for farming. Senator Bach.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Osmek, I'm just curious about the effective dates. I mean, the effective date with the death of an owner is July 1st, which seems a little odd. Why would you just wouldn't do that August 1st? But even more interestingly is the amendment with the provision relative to cell towers has an effective date immediately following enactment. So I'm wondering, is there a project actually underway that it needs a special effective date, or what's the reason for that?
Senator Osmek.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I'm not aware of an active cell tower project that would be impacted by this. I'd be certainly amenable to making an enactment date changes. I don't think that necessarily changes a lot in the bill. I'd be more than willing to adjust the enactment date on line 2.10 to August 1st. And any other suggestions on the effective date of the cell towers, I'd be willing to take.
Mr. Chairman, if we're actually helping somebody, I just would like to acknowledge that, I guess, because that's a special provision.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I had one person on my testimony list.
Court Holton. Mr. Holton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Court Holton, and I'm here today representing Verizon Wireless Corporation. The answer to Senator Bach's question is that the effective date in the amendment is arbitrary. It doesn't need to be July 1.
Well, Mr. Holton, the purpose of the Ag Preserve Program is to give these parcels that are ag land and are going to remain green space a property tax break, so that the surrounding landowners will pay the tax for them, but then they will have the enjoyment of having green space around them. I'm not exactly sure that a cell tower fits into the definition of enjoying green space very well. I have some pretty significant concerns about this, Mr. Holton. Can you help me out with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In building out the technology infrastructure in rural Minnesota, the high-speed internet traffic is critical. It's not just nice, fun gadgets to have. It's critical to the economy of rural Minnesota. And in order to go from point A to point B, and typically this might be from metro going up north, there has to be installments of towers. In the more metro areas, there is usually a pre-existing structure that can serve that purpose. As you get further out into the rural area, you will find more situations where the positioning of the tower has to be within a certain area. It's not just proximity, it's angle. And there'll be places where you have to use bare ground. Typically, we would put up a monopole, which the footprint of that is 40 feet by 30 feet, which I do not believe takes any significant amount of tillable land out of production. The next one, unlike the windmills that are now everywhere if you drive out in western Minnesota and the power lines, the next installment in a build-out will be miles away, and you won't see it from the current installment. And that might be on a building, or it might require land. In terms of farm use, the use of this, of course, is universal. But we are already powering or controlling various gadgets, for instance, in irrigation, where the a unit in the field will talk to the base unit, and you'll know what your moisture rate is, and you can control the irrigation system. It won't be long before planting will be done by unmanned planters, and this will all be run through wireless, because you can't have a tractor carrying a wire technology. But well beyond that is the overall community, what high-speed internet does for businesses, law enforcement, hospitals, and healthcare, and one of the strongest pressures we have these days comes from people in rural locations that are saying, we need this out here, and it is a deficit if you don't have it. In terms of tilling property for crop use or animal use, the footprint of these cell towers is basically irrelevant. The way that the law was written has extreme limitations on what you can put. Even storage facilities have been denied in some of the cases are older cases, and we don't absolutely have a case on cell towers. But in reading those cases, I would be hesitant to put a lot of capital into a route that would involve a number of placements on ag preservation land, and so we're trying to accomplish that. And we have to go through all of the steps, the federal and state and local permitting steps, so that it doesn't. We're not leaping over any hurdles. We're just making this one of the possible things that you can put on a farm. And I really don't see a downside for it.
Well, Mr. Holton, other than it's probably not in conformity with agriculture, and I mean, clearly a cell tower is not agriculture. I can't figure out how you're going to play that, but it also is not going to impact much of greater Minnesota. This is the Metropolitan Ag Preserve Program, and there are three counties participating in the program besides the metropolitan area: Waseca, Winona, and Wright. So it's a fairly narrow program. It doesn't seem to me the direction we should be going. I carried the Green Acres legislation. I would guess that the next step would then be to have those acres have, and they're not, that's not the purpose of the property tax reduction programs for ag preserves. I just don't think that's within the character of that program, but we'll see. And you know, we can have further conversation, Senator Osmick, with where the direction of this bill is going. Anything else, members? Mr. Holt?
Mr. Chairman, just for clarity's sake, I believe in the amendment, both Chapter 40A and 473H are dealt with. So the non-metro, the rural area, is in the amendment, and that's where we're having the issues. We have plenty of sites in the metro area.
And, Mr. Holton, we'll have further conversation. I'll have staff bring you a copy of this. It's the Senate File 1830 with the A1 amendment added. And so we'll get a copy of this to you. It says Waseca, Winona, and Wright. But we'll get you a copy. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 1830? Anything else, Senator Osmick?
Not really, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate laying it over for possible inclusion.
Sure,
I understand that the cell tower, a cell tower is not necessarily directly involved in agriculture production. However, as we continue as a society to move and expand, having these cell towers with a very small footprint within an ag preserve, I understand it, you could consider it that's the camel's nose under the tent for other things to come in and say, well, we're just pretty minor too. But when it comes to these type of communications, having those expand into these areas, I think, is not necessarily an unacceptable small intrusion considering. And also, there is local, as stated, there's local permitting that if a local jurisdiction doesn't want that there, if the citizens that are in that area want to see the green space, that they can, through their local officials, say, no, we don't want to put that there in that ag preserve. So the locals still would have that. So I'd appreciate your consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Osmond. Chair, I'll lay Senate File 1830 as amended over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we have got two sets of minutes in our packet, April 8th and April 9th. If you could take a couple minutes and look those over and make sure they're accurate.
Chair, I would move approval.
Senator Senator moves approval of the April 8th and the April 9th minutes. Everything okay, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The minutes are adopted. Thank you, members. And here, would you hand that to John? John?
Take up Senate File 1636. Senator Scoy.
Give me 1 minute. Oh, I just got to get the bill here.
Senator Scoy, you have the A1 delete everything amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And members, I apologize for the delete everything amendment. It became apparent that doing a line and page amendment was extremely difficult to accomplish. This is not the first time this bill has been heard, so I need to walk through what's happening with this. Really, members, it is a fairly small changes that are being made to the electrical generation tax reform bill that we have had in front of committee already this session. And this is the bill that is a result of the study that the department did last year analyzing, first of all, the production tax on wind and solar, but then further they had extensive conversations with the larger and other electrical generation units. What the bill does, just to refresh your memory, is move away from the current valuation method of personal property to a production and capacity tax. That is still in the bill. We do eliminate the personal property, the sliding scale exemption, the pollution control exemption, and streamline the valuation to be just the production of the plant and the capacity of the plant. So those are all the same pretty much as the bill was heard in committee earlier. The amendment does a couple of things. It does clarify the transition aid. The transition aid is the part of the bill that makes sure that local governments are kept whole. And we needed to make some changes to take into account the production tax that wind and solar were paying and make sure that those communities that were receiving that production tax were kept whole. The draft also reinstates the pollution control exemption, but only for other facilities besides electrical generation. As we repealed that provision, we found out that there's a few other businesses in Minnesota that are utilizing that. I think there's a dairy farm, a couple of other industries that utilize that exemption, and we didn't want to take that away from those, just away from the electrical generation. So we clarify that in the amendment. And then we add As we discussed the first time this bill was in front of the committee, the possibility of having an adjustment to the payment that is being made based on changes, you know, as the economy grows. So we have added an adjustment to the production tax based on the energy information average. It's a document published by the U.S. Energy Information Organization. It's published in, I think it's monthly, but we will be using the residential component of that, not the all sectors component, because the residential is more stable. But what the point of this is so that the host communities would have some growth in the revenues that they receive based on what Minnesotans are paying for electricity. And so that is about what we have in the A1 amendment, unless Mr. Sylvia has some additional information that I have not brought forward. No? Okay.
Ready to move the A1 amendment?
I would move the A1 amendment.
Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And so, Mr. Chair and members, I think the primary purpose of this meeting is when we heard this bill earlier, we told everybody that was a preliminary hearing. We were going to try to do some more work. We have had an email list going with the stakeholders, and I think that the purpose of this meeting would be primarily to hear from them. I see there's a pretty good list, including the Department of Revenue of testifiers. Mr. Chair, I might advise that perhaps the DOR could be last in case we start to run out a little time. They would be easier for them to come back. I see there's some folks from Otter Tail, and well, no, he's not Otter Tail, but Nobles County. Let's start working on the testifier list and
sure.
See what they have to say, and then we'll get the department.
I'll call up, and then Senator Sinjim has a question. But we'll call up Gene Metz from Nobles County and Eric Olson from Great River. Yes, Senator Sinjim, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Squire, perhaps Consul, could you just spend a minute or so, could someone, going to line or lines 9-1 through 9-6, where specifically it talks about the generation and capacity rates shall be increased annually according to an index. I'm just trying to understand that a little bit. It's sort of an automatic pilot kind of thing, as I interpret it. Could
sure.
Somebody kind of just explain that
sure.
paragraph to me?
Senator Scully.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sinjim, yes, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but that is the question of what we're doing here with regard to that provision. When we looked at the host communities, there is currently activity going on where they're expanding and improving, well, maybe not expanding, but just improving their facilities. That would be added under the current system. That would be added into their personal property tax base and would increase the revenues to those host right. communities. So as time goes on, as facilities upgrade, there will be depreciation of the personal property, but there will also be increases to values based on the investments that they make in those facilities. I think that over time, if you look at it, the value of the personal property has been gradually increasing. So host communities get a gradual increase in revenues, not unlike an inflationary adjustment might be, but not based on inflation.
Okay.
So we thought, well, we don't want these host communities to be at a fixed number forever. You know, if we don't have some adjusting mechanism in here, then the production doesn't change. They'll be fixed at that rate forever, irrespective of what the activity that goes okay. on in the generation facility. We didn't want to just use a CPI or some other inflationary measurement. So we looked around and found this published data that's reported to the energy organization. on what Minnesotans are paying for their residential electricity. And we base this inflationary adjustment on that number. So the utilities will have the certainty that as they go to the PUC asking for rate increases, some small component of it will be impacted on their tax bill.
Okay.
And there will be that slight increase. But, and it's tied to the rates of electricity for residential units in Minnesota. And it's relatively stable. One of the questions that you're going to hear about today is that there is now going to be some risk and some uncertainty for electrical generation facilities that have long-term contracts. We're trying to minimize the risk by giving as much certainty as we can in these formulas.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and appreciate that.
Mr. Metz.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1636. My name is Gene Metz. I'm a fourth-generation grain and livestock farmer from Nobles County, Minnesota, and also a commissioner there. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the 18 counties which make up the Rural Minnesota Energy Board, a joint powers board of southern and southwestern Minnesota counties that have been closely monitoring state policy and local impacts relating to renewable energy development. In fact, it was the Rural Minnesota Energy Board that spearheaded the negotiations roughly 15 years ago to establish the wind generation production tax. Since the establishment of that production tax, wind power, and more recently solar, have become a big presence in our corner of the state. The 18-county Rural Minnesota Energy Board contains approximately 2,000 turbines at this time, which in 2014 paid roughly $9 million in production taxes. The Rural Minnesota Energy Board's main concern today is the proposed erosion of the production tax rate from a rate of 0.12 cents per kilowatt to 0.005 cents, a reduction in our case down to about 42% of our original production tax. What does that mean to a county? Let's take a look at my home county of Nobles. In 2015, the production tax will be about $1.25 million returned to us. The landowners hosting the turbines will earn about $6,000 a turbine, and that'll be about another $1.1 million. Looks like a good deal, but what are the costs? A rural electric co-op has estimated the rates have increased a half a cent a kilowatt due to the fact that they're producing more energy locally than what can be consumed, and the excess has to be sold back into the MISO system, sometimes at a loss. There's continuous road upkeep for counties and townships. In this case, Nobles County will take roughly a $750,000 hit in a new tax rate proposed according to 2014 rates. And I have to apologize. I just saw the amendment figures this morning, and it would be slightly more than that. But we realize that there's a transition aid portion built into this formula. My question is, when we go to transition aid, are those dollars now become a state liability? Right now, the production tax is a neutral negative impact on the state of Minnesota. We get, as counties, trying to make budgets a little bit leery when we see transitions and not sure if they're going to be there from year to year. Renewable energy production has been a big part of the county's economic development. A neighboring county of ours bonded for road improvements last year. They're predicting to use a majority of their production tax to pay those bond payments. If for some reason that transition aid would disappear, what do they do now? Have to raise their levies. The Rural Minnesota Energy Board will continue to support expansion of renewables if it's done right. We strongly request that this committee would pull this bill until a closer look can be done on the effect of the participating counties. Please consider the Rural Minnesota Energy Board's guidance and any guidance as you go down this path. Thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Metz. Questions from the committee. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. It's a fair concern about the transition aid, but in the monetary scheme of for the facilities, all of these jurisdictions will be receiving more money in total revenue than they currently are, because of the mechanism that we're using that puts the value not only in the 20% to the towns and the 80% to the county, but also we're putting part of the value into the school district, and then we're making everybody whole. So the question about the transition aid is valid. I get that, and I understand that there's been unallotments in the past, and that's a concern that the counties have about the state in general, and we're going to hear that from other jurisdictions. But as far as the overall return to the jurisdictions, it will be more than they're currently getting. At the same time, the wind energy is receiving a tax reduction, pretty significantly, actually. And there's two reasons for that. One, we didn't want wind to have a higher production tax than nuclear or coal, so they received a lower rate. And when you multiply that rate through the relatively low tax rate that these southwest counties have, many times around 0.43, 0.44, the tax gets to be quite low. So I think overall they'll be whole, but the concern about the transition tax is real, and I can't say that the legislature won't ever make an action against that. I just can't do that because we can't bind them. But you would hope that the importance of electrical generation in this state, that people would look long and hard before they undid this. But
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I cannot find in the bill here, how long does the transition aid last?
Senator Scoid.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, it lasts until the county has grown beyond the valuations that they have on the date of this change. So they would never have a negative impact as long as their values are below where they are. And once their values are up, then they would be kept whole by that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Do we have any estimate on what sort of time frame we're looking at? Maybe that's in the fiscal note.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, it depends on each jurisdiction to the size of it, and it also depends on the amount of growth that they're going to have within their jurisdiction, which are kind of hard to predict at this point. But some of them, it's going to be a few. It's going to be a while. I mean, it's not going to go away in a couple of years on some of these jurisdictions.
That's enough for right now. Thank you.
Further discussion. Thank you. Before we take from Mr. Olson, Mr. Peterson pointed out, Senator Scoia, on page 9, line 3, the delete everything still says that you'd be basing the change on the price of electricity for all sectors. He suggests you might want to delete all sectors and, I assume, insert residential customers.
Mr. Chair, could I do an oral amendment on page 9, line 3, after electricity, delete for all sectors and or delete all sectors and insert residential?
You might want to say residential customers, perhaps.
I'm seeing a no. It's residential.
Just residential. Okay. Senator Scoia moves that. Is there any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Olson, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good morning. I am Eric Olson, Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to provide Great River's comments regarding Senate File 1636. Great River Energy owns 9 power plants in Minnesota that are affected by this bill. We calculate that the net impact of the bill will be to increase Great River Energy's property taxes on these units by approximately $200,000 over the roughly $3 million that we now pay with respect to these units. As a not-for-profit generation and transmission cooperative, we pay close attention to any measures that increase our costs, for it is the ultimate member consumer of our member distribution cooperatives who will bear the burden of the tax increase. Nevertheless, Great River Energy recognize that the bill is intended to reform the property tax system regarding electric generating units, and we generally believe that that calculating the tax base based on a combination of generation capacity and actual electrical output is reasonably related to the value of the units to utilities like Great River Energy. We respectfully submit, however, that the annual tax base escalator based on an overall retail rate increases be eliminated from the final bill. We believe that the escalator is not necessary to advance the bill's core purposes of providing certainty and stability to the taxing districts. In addition, increases in utility rates do not correlate to the value of the generating units to the utility. Because the rate increases may not be related to the utility and may be caused by factors other than increased costs related to the units. For example, they could be caused by factors related to regulatory obligations, et cetera. Finally, electric consumers will be harmed by the escalator because after bearing the rate increase that is the cause of the escalation in the property taxes on the unit, they will also bear the cost of that escalator. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. Rena Virgoliak and Grania McKiernan. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rena Verdaljak, and I'm a senior tax analyst at Minnesota Power. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you this morning regarding Senate File 1636. Minnesota Power is supportive of moving to a more transparent, predictable, and stable property tax system for utility property currently assessed under a unitary valuation system. We appreciate Senator Scoy's efforts to start the conversation on how we can accomplish this goal. Under the current unit value system, the Department of Revenue calculates a market value for the entire utility based on three indicators of value, which include cost, income, and market. The factor weightings applied to the three indicators of value can be viewed as subjective, and the final weightings can unexpectedly shift the property tax liability by millions of dollars. The factor weightings are not determined until mid-year, which makes cash planning and budgeting very difficult for the utility. There are a number of statutory exclusions, and while some are straightforward, others seem to be debated on an annual basis. This uncertainty leads to time and money spent to obtain outside legal counsel and valuation specialists and can ultimately lead to litigation. Senate File 1636 begins to address some of these issues by moving to a more straightforward production and capacity-based valuation for electric generation equipment. It does not, however, address the taxation of transmission and distribution, nor does it address the taxation of utility structures in which the electric generating equipment is housed, which are currently part of the unit valuation. At present, the bill suggests a dual system, since the unit valuation would not be replaced in its entirety. We would be supportive of working toward the creation of one system. We are interested in becoming part of the discussion on how we can accomplish this goal. We believe this bill is a good starting point toward a simpler, more predictable taxing system that offers stability to utilities and host communities alike. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for your time. I would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, think that in time we should move toward including transmission and the other electrical facilities in this plan. It just was more than we could undertake this year. But I think in the long run, that should be everybody's goal.
Thank you. Senator, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, because I have a hard time with your last name, but how did you feel about the inflator portion of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator, as a whole, we're opposed to the inflator for a variety of reasons, one being that utilities are the only system taxed on personal property, the only industry taxed on personal property in the entire state now, and adding this inflator just kind of seems to add to that inequality. So at this time, we're opposed to the inflator.
Senator Scalia.
And the only, Mr. Chair and Senator Gazalka, the only thing I would add is what I said earlier, is that I understand the concerns about an inflator, and I generally have been opposed to those kind of autopilot things, but I have concerns for the whole cities that they would not just have a static number kind of forever if production doesn't grow. And so that's the concern, and, you know, we're open to conversations about that. But I think we came up with a pretty stable number that is tied directly to the cost of electricity in the state.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I see the dilemma of making the shift, and, you know, unless they can propose some other idea to fill in those gaps, I understand where you're coming from.
And I think one of the things you can say about the gradual increase is that right now the problem we're putting in a big new facility, there's a huge jump in property tax, and then, I mean, it's been unstable for both the communities and them. And if we don't have any inflator in there, and then the legislature sometimes says we got to do something, then you have the jumps again. But Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scalia or anyone, can you help me with this? This assumes, as I understand it, that the value of a wind turbine or a solar farm or whatever is going to increasingly increase. But it would seem to me, not unlike an old car, that these things do, you know, they will wear out. But yet we're increasing the value on a piece of equipment, presumably increasing the value on a piece of equipment which, in some cases, you know, a company or an individual owns is may be ready to retire just from the standpoint of obsolescence. Am I tracking on that? Could that happen?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, we're not taxing the equipment. We're taxing the production of electricity.
Production, okay.
And so it's the value of the electricity that's being taxed because
okay,
of the
that's
production.
Helpful. Thank
and
you.
Then hence the connection to the residential rate.
Senator Gazelka and Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Senjum and Senator Scott. As I'm thinking through that, if I understood it right, under your scenario, they'd come back and buy new equipment eventually because it'd be getting old, but that's when there'd be a bigger tax, and we're trying to shift from that to just doing it on the actual cost of the electricity. So it's a shift away from that, you know, versus in other businesses when they buy a big piece of equipment, they deduct the whole amount and reduce their taxes, but this is done differently.
Yeah. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Scoy, I'm understanding that there's an increased cost to the taxpayers because of the transition aid. There's a general fund appropriation for some period of time, not totally sure how long that is yet. But then there must be a benefit somewhere why we're increasing the taxpayers' burden. And I'm trying to figure out what that is. Is it lower rates for the consumers? Why would we want to increase the general fund obligations?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, this has been the challenge of this effort, is trying to get the shifts that are occurring, because there's winners and losers, and we're trying to minimize both. We don't want too many people having a significant loss of revenue through the whole city, but we also don't want too many of the producers having a huge increase in taxes. Now, for Xcel, because they have facilities in a number of jurisdictions, they'll kind of balance off. One of their facilities might have a pretty large increase in tax, and one of them might actually have a reduction. This is the spreadsheet for the different counties on what the impacts are. And the effort of the transition aid was to make the host communities whole. And so I think if you do the math through, the net impact is that the state is picking up $10 to $12 million that used to be paid by utilities to these communities, and now the state is paying it. The rationale behind that is that this is going to be beneficial to the state over the long term to have a more stable taxation for electrical generation, so these industries that are producing electricity in Minnesota to continue to expand and build plants here and produce electricity for our citizens under a more stable, common sense system that makes sense to them. And that was the effort. But it's this shifting between jurisdictions because we have so many of these gas peaking plants received exemptions. Well, clearly, if you remove their exemption, their property taxes are going up. Now, they do get to offset that with their payment in lieu payment. So some of them it's larger and some of it's smaller. It's all over the place. And so that is the primary rationale for this, is because we had such a mixed up system under current scenarios. And when you try to make it uniform, there's winners and losers, and we're trying to mitigate that as much as we can.
Thank you. Just a follow up. So who is unhappy with the current system? In other words, who thinks that there's this, you've described the issue of fluctuation, and whom is that harming? Who is supporting this change and the transition aid and the government or the state involvement there?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, I think overall all of the testifiers recognize the need for a better system. They have some issues with some provisions in the bill, but we'll work our way through those. For example, there was a company that wanted to build a plant in southwestern Minnesota. This last fall, they started on their proposal, and they came into the office, and the first thing they asked for was a personal property tax exemption, so that they're competitive with all the other personal property tax exemptions in this state. Well, we kind of said, no, we're trying to do away with those because it doesn't make good sense to keep doing that. Well, then their facility didn't work anymore. But if we go to this type of production tax, then their project might work. And so that's the goal of this, is to not have this continual discussion in the tax committee about personal property tax exemptions and pollution control exemptions. I've carried these bills, so I know the controversy about them. And we're trying to get away with that. And I think it will make a better plan, and particularly if we're able to extend it to transmission, as the Minnesota Power testified, so we can undo the unitary part. But we're not there yet. But I think over time, that's doable.
Thank you. And just one final question. Thank you for the history on that. What about ratepayers? How does this bill, if enacted in its current form, how do you think this would it would impact ratepayers?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, the rate increases will have to go through the PUC. The utilities will make their case based on their costs. This will be part of their costs. We have heard from Xcel earlier that they are going to have a 9% valuation increase statewide. Now, that's not a 9% tax increase, but it is an increase. They will make a case on that. But if they do a major capital investment in one of their facilities, that also increases their property taxes. And I understand they have a number of those scheduled for the coming years. So the 9% valuation increase here might be offset by all the things that they've got scheduled to as they work on improving their facilities through the years. So those are kind of hard things to speculate on, but it all will have to go through the PUC. And if I'm wrong on that, I think these guys will correct me, but I think that's the way that will work.
Thank you.
Ms. McKiernan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Skoy. We very much appreciate this conversation and an effort to address this problem that's been before the committee for many, many years. We also support the idea of moving away from the unit valuation method toward a production-based valuation system. It would be simpler, clearer, less time-consuming, less resource-consuming, as you've heard from the others. Under this bill, we would still have to go through the unit valuation process because it doesn't include transmission and distribution, nor the production buildings. But we appreciate the this first step towards towards getting away from the unit valuation system. There are some aspects of the bill that we would like to continue to work on with Senator Scoy. As you've mentioned, Senator Nelson, the bill has a valuation increase of about 9%. That would translate in, we think, into about a 3.5% tax increase. And we'd like to move towards a more revenue-neutral starting point, recognizing the challenge that, you know, revenue-neutral between all of the facilities and all the energy producers and all of the host communities is a huge challenge. The inflator is a concern for Xcel. If we step back to consider it, the bill is changing the personal property tax, but utilities still pay real property taxes on the land and buildings, just like every other industry and business in these host communities for local services. So the personal property tax changed now to a production-based valuation tax is still an additional tax, and it's not clear to us what the need is for an additional inflator on top of that. The question was raised in the Department of Revenue's study that came out of this committee last year, and there were a lot of legacy costs and issues that were brought into that study, and no conclusive recommendations or outcomes that utilities pose additional or different costs on communities than other industries in terms of, you know, pollution or noise, other kinds of impacts. So the need for an inflator on top of the additional tax is not clear to us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. McKernan. Questions from the committee? If not, thank you. Mr. Peterson from Coalition Utility System Cities and Lauren Logtug. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bradley Peterson here on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities, representing seven communities that host very large power facilities. And one of those groups that has occupied much of the Senate Tax Committee's time over the years working on these issues. And so we certainly appreciate Senator Scoy's thoughtful opening of a discussion here. I'd also like to acknowledge and thank Senator Scoy and staff for their openness as we go through this process and the very inclusive nature of the stakeholder process that they've established. So just a few comments on sort of where we stand from the host community perspective. We do appreciate the changes that were made based in the last hearing, including the addition of the adjustment factor to ensure that as we go through time that we are not capping the value of the machinery and that if you know, production and capacity do continue at these individual facilities at the same rate, that there is some ability to continue to capture ongoing value. And so the adjustment factor for the host communities is actually very important. And one item related to the adjustment factor that we would note is that, you know, since it is based on the retail price of electricity, that there have been years in our review of this where that has actually been a negative number. And so we would actually suggest that perhaps that can't go below zero going forward. We also appreciate the clarification of the transition aid. In reading it, however, it does appear that there might be a timing issue with the payments, the certifications and the payments of the aid. The way that we read the language as it is, it says that your aid is certified in August and you get paid in December for sort of that current year. And so it would be unlike the LGA system where you get an aid certified in August. You then have the opportunity as a local government to set your levies and set your budget for the next year, and then your aid is paid in the next year. And so that's One concern that we have related to the transition aid. The other concern related to the transition aid was raised by the commissioner from Nobles County, and that is the state's history of paying aids and credits as committed in the past. However, we do have a more positive experience with the previous utility transition aid that was instituted in, I think, 2008 or 2009, where at that time, due to rule changes from the Department of Revenue, in order to make up for that gap that would be occurring, the legislature did introduce a transition aid. And despite the financial challenges in 2009, 2010, 2011 that the state had, because of the importance of that and the connection between, you know, real-life events on the ground, the state did make good on their commitments there. And so that gives us some confidence, at least, that in this case and for this particular issue, that the state would hopefully make good on their commitments. And I think to maybe answer Senator Nelson's question fairly directly in terms of, you know, we're making this outlay of general fund for this transition aid, and what are we getting for that? You are protecting the property taxpayers in those communities where the valuations would be changing and who would otherwise either suffer a loss of services based on less revenue to the community or an increase in property taxes. So you're really protecting those property taxpayers with the transition aid, and so we appreciate that. As we are going forward, you know, our communities, now that we feel like we've got kind of the whole setting here, are really looking at, you know, running all kinds of different scenarios based on what we now know of kind of the intent here. So we, I think, have a good understanding of what is going on. And now it's, I think, trying to answer kind of all of the what ifs. And then if this is to go forward, to get to a point where we can take a little bit of a leap of faith, knowing that the Senate Tax Committee and the legislature in general, I think, wants to work with host communities and protect them as best they can and create a fair deal for folks. So with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Questions? Senator Scoia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate Mr. Peterson's comments with regard to what I'm going to now call the power cost adjustment. I think that'll be the word to use. And, Mr. Peterson, we understand that there's some timing issues with regard to this new property tax mechanism, and so we'll start working on effective dates and making sure that the concern committee is that make sure there isn't a gap here, you know, between the current system and the new system. So we'll have to figure that out. But, yes, that's a very good point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lautog. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lauren Lautog from Otter Tail Power Company in Fergus Falls, and I am appearing on behalf of my company. I'd like to thank Senator Scoia for raising this discussion and this bill. I think a couple of things that he's seeking here that are useful. One is simplicity of calculating how property taxes are done from year to year. I think that's a very good goal. And the other is, I think I see him seeking in this bill predictability for the taxing district. So from year to year, you've got a flow of revenue that's fairly predictable as compared to over the years, we've based property taxes on real property, or I'm sorry, on personal property. And the downside of using personal property or assets that are personal is that they decline in value with time, and of course taxes decline in value with time. So Otter Tail probably has the least at stake in the debate as far as the coal generating utilities go. Our largest and newest units happen to be in North Dakota and South Dakota. We do have a unit in Fergus Falls called Hoot Lake Plant, but first I'll mention we have a gas plant at Solway, Minnesota, which is in Senator Scoia's district. It has been exempt since 2003, and what we mean by exempt is that we were required to negotiate with the local taxing districts to arrive at some agreeable form of taxation. And we agreed with Beltrami County to tax that facility at 150% of the real property value as assessed by the Beltrami County assessor. So even though we got an exemption, we still pay 50% more than other business property owners in Beltrami County. Our calculations with respect to that facility, just as an example, we see an increase, not a large increase, but an increase. And so I think we're finding results similar to what Mr. Olson mentioned for Great River Energy. Hoot Lake plant is an older 130-megawatt coal plant in Fergus Falls. We've agreed with the Public Utilities Commission that we will close Hoot Lake plant at the end of 2020. Now, we spent $9 million last summer upgrading Hoot Lake plant for what's called the mercury and air toxics rule, and that allows us to run the plant through year 2020. EPA regulates all fossil fuel units, and so in addition to the mercury and air toxics rule, there's the National Ambient Air Quality Rule. That's used for ozone. There's the coal combustion rule, and there will be increasing levels of imposition of rules on NOx and on sulfur dioxide. And finally, there's the Clean Power Plan that EPA proposed in June of last year. So my point I'm making is that over the years to come, between 2020 and 2030, there will be an attrition of coal units all over the Midwest. It's anticipated just between MATS and the Clean Power Plan, more than 100 gigawatts of coal would be taken out of the Midwest with respect to their use as units for MISO and other reliability zones. When we get to 2020, after that date, we have to replace Hoot Lake plant in Fergus Falls. In the modern world, you can only replace coal with three things: wind, natural gas, and solar. You can't build coal, and for practical purposes, you can't build nuclear. So we are already in the early stages of figuring out what we're going to do in 2021. Do we put a unit in Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota? We actually own properties in all three states, so that if we were to replace Hoot Lake plant in any of these three states, we have a place where we could land. Would we not land in Fergus Falls? We would not. There's not enough natural gas in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, so we can't build a new gas unit in Fergus Falls. We will build more wind, and we'll probably build solar. But with respect to choosing among the states, it will be an economic decision for the most part. And so with respect to gas units, we're really Minnesota's in a competitive situation with other states. And so I think that needs to be taken into consideration as we continue to work on the plan here together. The inflator would be have a negative impact on a decision to locate a unit in Minnesota compared to any other state. I'm not aware of an inflator in other states. So again, predictability is a very good thing. We've not worked through the solar and wind cost comparisons, but we do recognize in rural Minnesota the need for taxing districts, counties, and townships. They have to be able to support their road systems in rural Minnesota. And so for that reason, wind and solar taxes are useful for that purpose, and so we support those. Mr. Chair, those are all my comments, and I'll answer any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
Questions from the committee. Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the only thing I would say about the facility in my district is I carried the personal property tax exemption, and obviously I was successful. But it lends itself to the conversation of that plant is making this 150% payment in lieu of, where there's a plant on the western side of Minneapolis that is doing something completely different, and there's just no consistency to it. So I think in the scheme of things, consistency would be a positive.
Thank you. Thank you both. Ms. Engel King and then Mr. Cummings from the department. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I have an addition on my that I'm not sure that you
I
have.
I didn't have any other names. Who did you?
Mr. Schoenier, Southern Municipal Power Agency.
Yes, he's coming forward. Mr. Schoenier, welcome to the committee as well. Ms. Engel King, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engel King, and I represent Geronimo Energy, a wind and solar developer located in Edina, Minnesota. Like everyone who's testified before me, I appreciate the thoughtful look at changing some systems of taxes that haven't necessarily always made sense in the utility industry. However, I must confess I do have concerns about Senator Scoy's bill. My first concern is the characterization of this change as moving to a capacity and generation tax. Coming from an industry that actually uses a generation tax, to us this comes to mean it is a tax that is directly levied on the generation of the plant. Instead, this tax moves us to a value-based tax whereby the value of plant is determined by the level of production times some arbitrary value that is listed in this legislation. This kind of tax, unlike a production tax for wind, where we have a relatively stable and known tax that will continue over the life of the project, introduces new variabilities. In addition to the variability of production, which is not terribly variable for something like a wind or solar project, but can be very variable for a thermal project such as a coal or gas project, you have that variability. Now you also have the variability of the levy rate, and then you add the variability of the potential arbitrary value that could be changed by legislative means. And on top of that, you're going to add an escalator. And so you can see that whereby this simplifies taxes for some folks, it greatly complicates it for industries that are currently under the existing production tax production tax, which is levied on wind and solar projects. In addition, this tax seems to be particularly well-suited to utility-owned generation plants. Utilities can regularly pass through their price changes to their customers and can do that. And, in fact, when they appear before a regulatory, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, for a rate case, those taxes are considered a pass-through item. They're not subject to the determination by the commission whether they or not they are recoverable. They are simply toted up and passed right through into rates, whereby this tax seems to ignore an entire sector of the generating industry in Minnesota, and that is the independent power production industry. Independent power producers, which include wind and solar producers, but also producers of some other types of generating plants, largely natural gas-based, set their prices in advance through contract with the utility. And while prospective plants can set their prices, keeping in mind the new tax structure and the escalation structure, there are many, many plants already under long-term 20, 25, 30-year contracts with utilities in the state that don't have the benefit of making those adjustments to recover this change in taxes. For some people, these taxes may go down. For other people, they will go up. It will be very difficult for some providers to absorb this tax change when they've already locked in their prices with the utility, and that can lead to the deterioration of maintenance or the abandonment of plant in Minnesota. And, you know, that's another concern that I hope the committee takes into account as they continue to work on this bill. My final comment is that one of the things that does concern me about this bill is what we see as actually a large increase in the potential for taxation of solar in the state. Solar is a new industry. It's a budding industry. Up to last year, it was completely exempt from paying taxes, either property taxes or any other kind of tax. And last year, Geronimo actually came to the legislature and asked you to institute a production tax for solar because we did not feel that it was fair that the communities that were hosting our projects did not receive similar revenues to communities that host other generation projects. And in addition to agreeing to institute the production tax, the legislature also instituted a commercial tax on the underlying property on which a solar project rests. And in our calculation, that underlying commercial property tax does not go away with this tax, But with the added way that this will be taxed, and considering that the levy rates are not necessarily as low for solar projects as they may be in some of the counties that host wind, we are seeing that the taxes on some of our solar projects are more than doubling. Sometimes they will be up to 130 to 200% increase in taxes on projects that we also have locked in on long-term fixed-rate contracts. So I think that the idea of rationalizing the utility tax system is a great idea. I think that this is a good step toward getting there, but I do think that we need to take another look at this bill with the changes to the independent power production industry taxation in mind, and I appreciate your consideration of my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Engelking. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question of the testifier. Did I hear you say that you were expecting a 200% tax increase as a result of this bill or as a result of some of the changes that were made last year?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, it's as the result of this bill. It does actually impact solar disproportionately concerned. We've evaluated our wind facilities, and we don't see a disproportionate change. In many cases, we do see a slight reduction, as you noted, but it does appear to disproportionately impact solar taxation.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask the testifier to work with us on understanding that, because that's not what we have been experiencing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, we have a meeting set up with you on Thursday for that purpose.
Great.
Thank you. Ms. Engelking, when you said the commercial property value for the underlying property, is that what's causing that higher jump there, or is that not the factor? I'm just curious how big of a factor that
Mr.
is.
Mr. Chair, no. That tax was instituted last year, and we have already assumed that in our calculation. It actually has more to do with changing this from a straight production tax to a value tax based on production times the value that's been applied to solar.
And Senator Scoy. Mr. Chair, if I could just remind the committee of the conversation of last year, when the solar request came into the committee, we had a pretty good discussion about what kind of modifications we could potentially make to this bill that would be different than what wind had. And actually, we were proposing at that time changes to the wind production tax. And we decided rather than do some actions on a short-term basis that we would be wiser to institute the production tax on solar and have the department do a study. And so, hence, that's what led us to here today. We never made any indication that what we were doing last year was ongoing.
Thank you. Mr. Schoenherr, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and members. I'm Chris Schoenherr. I represent the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency and our 18-member municipal utilities across the state of Minnesota. In general, we, too, are supportive of the changes that are put forth in this bill. Anytime you can reduce complexity and increase certainty in taxes is a good thing. So we applaud the efforts of the senator on that. I have to admit that we're still working through the individual impacts to the communities that we serve and where our plants are hosted and cross-checking with them to ensure that the way we're reading the legislation is the same as theirs. At this point, we believe it'll have a modest to moderate increase in our property tax liability, which in turn will be translated to our member utilities. We have probably two concerns, and I wish I had some solutions to either one of those right now. I don't, but we look forward to working with folks on that. To the extent that our liability does increase, obviously that will has an upward pressure on rates themselves. Our rate-making process as municipal utilities is different. We will go through our local boards and commissions for that. And frankly, they're reluctant, and we're reluctant to ask for rate increases at any time. It's different depending on where that particular facility is. If it's a facility that's in one of our member communities, either the taxpayers of that community or the ratepayers of that community are really one and the same. But how you distribute those costs that will need to be collected will change, depending on whether it's through property taxes or through rates. Very different story for those facilities that we have that are in communities that we do not serve. So we're concerned about that and the potential of collecting revenues either on a property value basis versus an energy use basis can change the relative impact to folks either to be more progressive or less progressive from a tax perspective. We, too, are concerned about the escalator for some of the same reasons that the other testifiers have mentioned. Also, it's kind of the tyranny of averages. If utilities have made a major effort not to increase rates but feel the impact of that escalator based on the actions of other utilities that may have increased rates, we feel that there's something of a disconnect there. Understand the concerns of the communities about the need for an escalator, but we're hoping to find a different way to be able to tackle that particular issue. So in summary, we think the general direction is very positive. We'll continue to work to better understand it and to work with all the stakeholders and the senator. And want to commend the senator and his staff for being very open and helpful in this whole process. And we'll look forward to addressing the remaining issues.
Thank you, Mr. Schenker. Questions from the committee? Senator Skoy. I see Mr. Carlson would like to speak too, and then Paul Cummings.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the greater Minnesota counties, having regional centers in them in four counties here in the metropolitan area. I apologize that I did not get myself listed on the testimony, but the detailed runs on the county impact just became available. And I just want to raise one issue. I think the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities have already identified the timing issues. And there's just one additional issue. You frequently heard reference the unitary value approach to valuing this property and all other taxable personal property of the utilities currently. The one additional concern that I want to communicate is that right now in the analysis of this proposal, what I would refer to as an ad hoc adjustment is being made for essentially taking the electric generation property valued under this new production tax concept out of the value, but it does not take into account then the reallocation of the remaining personal property that would occur with the change in what are called the weights for those properties. Consequently, the concern I want to communicate is that if this goes into effect for taxes payable in 2016, that change or shift in valuation will not be taken into account in computing the transition aid. So if this could be delayed until the taxes payable in 2017, the department tells me that shift of valuation, which will go away from the host communities to other communities that now have the remaining unitarily valued personal property, would be taken into account and would be captured by the transition aid. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Cummings, welcome to the committee.
Greetings, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource on this bill. Under this proposal, the personal property tax on electric generation machinery and the existing wind and solar energy production taxes will be eliminated. The proposal would create a new tax base for electric generating machinery using a combination of capacity generation and spent nuclear fuel time-specified rates. Among other reforms, the proposal would also create a transition aid for counties, cities, and towns, and school districts in which net tax capacity is reduced due to changes made to the valuation and taxation of electric generation machinery. First off, Mr. Chair, Mr. Eric Ouellette and Mr. John Van Nurden are here in case there's any questions that they could answer from the department. I wanted to thank you, Senator Skoy, for working with the Department of Revenue We appreciate the conversation and also your approach to our feedback. We look forward to continuing to have a productive conversation about this proposal. As we continue to share comments with you, we hope you would consider including those as part of your draft. We are committed to ensuring the tax code is administrable and fair. Although the proposal now refers to electric generation tax base instead of market value, this language adds complexity and may open the door for other property to be added as tax base rather than as market value. Moving away from or redefining market value could decrease uniformity across the same class of subjects. This draft seems to resolve the ambiguity, but we are still reviewing the draft to ensure we understand the effect of these changes, and we are able to share potential issues with you. Given it is already April, it is too late to develop and administer the tax provisions in this bill for assessment year 2015. Wind and solar energy production tax returns have already been processed, and amounts certified to the counties and property tax statements have already been mailed by the counties. The utility market value returns and property tax record returns have already been filed and are being completed. We would ask that you change the effective date to assessment year 2016 or later. Mr. Chair, it appears as drafted, there would be a gap year without payments for wind energy production tax and solar energy production tax for local jurisdictions in the changeover from a production tax model as assessed and paid in the same year to a property tax model as assessed in 1 year and paid in the next. I think this was already discussed in previous testimony. We would like to continue to work with the committee in order to try and solve that issue. Finally, the changes in this proposal are not insignificant from an administrative point of view. Implementation and administration of this new approach to electric generation taxation will require the department to invest human and technology resources in developing guidance, updating, and in some cases creating filing systems, educating taxpayers and localities, and clearly communicating all of these changes prior to implementation. So with that, Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, we thank you for the opportunity to be a resource. We look forward to continuing the conversation through this session on this bill and other important bills impacting Minnesotans.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the department. We got your list of concerns. We understand there's an issue with effective date. We're working on that now, and we would look forward to going through those as we move forward.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Senator Scoy?
I think, is there anybody else?
Nobody else has indicated.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I really want to thank you. I was concerned that we weren't having enough issues about this bill, but you have allayed that. I don't have that concern anymore. But, you know, we look forward to trying to work through this. Our goal is to try to make this work as best we can for all of Minnesota, so let's try to continue to work on it. And I think, Mr. Chair, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion, and the effort is ongoing.
Thank you, Senator Scoy. Did you have announcements or anything before?
Sure. Wednesday, tomorrow, members' bills starting at 8:30.
With that, if there's no further business, this meeting's adjourned.